This life is not an easy one. I've made enemies. Powerful enemies. I've put those I love in danger. But the one thing that has haunted me my entire life is finding the truth about my parents.
You're a wanted man, Peter Parker.
You don't believe what the police are saying, do you?
My dad has 500 officers looking for you.
500? That seems a bit excessive.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Mindspace Podcast. As you know, we've got a new front page. You can find us at www.mindspacepodcast.wordpress.com. So, this episode I'm very excited about because not only do we have an awesome movie to talk about that we just saw, but I also have a guest. I'd like to introduce you guys to GamerGirl84. How are you doing?
Hey guys, I'm doing good.
Good deal, good deal. Now, the movie we're going to talk about is The Amazing Spider-Man. We have just walked out of watching this movie, and so now we're going to give our thoughts on it, review it a little bit, and compare it to the previous trilogy for Spider-Man. So, this Spider-Man movie that we're talking about just got released this week, July 3rd. We actually went to a theater locally here in Houston, Texas, and we saw it in both IMAX and 3D. So we went big on this one. So how did you feel about the 3D that was shown in the movie?
Oh, okay. At first I have to say, skeptical because it's been a while since I've been to a 3D movie.
Right.
And the last time I went, I can't even remember what movie it was, but, you know, 3D wasn't that great, and it was like every once in a while something would pop out at you, and it really wasn't anything that made you feel like you were in the movie. So the experience that I had is most of the time I was focusing on what little 3D images there were, and because I was focusing on the 3D images, I got lost and wasn't really even involved in the movie. So that's the reason I haven't seen the 3D movie since then. But I was actually pleasantly surprised with how much 3D has really progressed, and it seems to be a lot better of an experience. It was like,
yeah.
I was in the – a lot of times I felt like I was in the scene or in the action of the movie because it kind of surrounded you. It wasn't just like images popping out here and there, but you were actually enveloped by the movie. So it was really, really cool. I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt kind of the same way. The last movie that I saw that had 3D this good was Avatar, I would say. And I know that's kind of a high bar to compare this movie to, but they use 3D throughout the movie and in what appeared to be almost every scene. And so as a result, it's kind of similar to Avatar. You started to forget that you were watching a 3D movie, and you just felt like you were actually sitting next to the characters
right.
Watching the scene happen.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Definitely.
So that was cool. And there were some points at which they wouldn't look weird without 3D, but with 3D you could tell that the scene was kind of shaped. Especially there's an ending scene where he's swinging at the camera, and yeah, he does that in every movie, so it's not anything out of the ordinary, but in 3D you could kind of tell that they used that scene to really highlight the 3D capabilities. Now, when we were at the theater, I said I couldn't really tell that the screen was bigger. Could you tell that this was IMAX?
Yes, I could. I think The difference was the theater that we were at. Well, the IMAX theaters that we've been to before, the chairs are at a lot more of a slant, like a theater.
Oh, like a lot steeper angle as you
yes.
go up.
Yeah, but I think that wasn't the case here, so then it made the screen maybe look a little smaller.
I see. But no, but I'm, you know, $15 a ticket sounds like a lot, but for the experience that we got, the quality of the movie that we saw and the extras that we got in the 3D, I was happy with it. I was happy, you know, for a $15 bill.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah, yeah. So getting into a little bit of the plot of the movie, in this movie we actually get to see Peter Parker's parents. We've never seen that before in one of the movies. We see him get dropped off with his Aunt May and Uncle Ben, and his parents disappear. We don't know exactly the situation surrounding that. But his parents really didn't play that big of a role in the movie. I mean, they talked about his father a lot, but it wasn't like his father was a real character in the movie. He was just kind of a placeholder to introduce and set up the story for Peter.
Yeah.
So this is where we can kind of start making some comparisons to the original trilogy starring Tobey Maguire. In a lot of ways, I felt that this movie mirrored that movie, both in how he developed his relationship with the people around them and also his relationship with the villain and how that developed. I thought that this mirrored very closely the first movie, just as far as events happened. But it seems like they learned a lot from the mistakes in that first movie as they made this one. And I'll ask you this question, but first of all, let me think. The guy who plays Spider-Man, Andrew Garfield, he does not talk to himself in this movie. Thank God.
Because yes.
Tobey Maguire drove me insane.
Yeah.
Always talking about. And the other thing that they didn't use, which I was proud, that line has become so cliched. With great power comes great responsibility. They didn't say that in this movie. They conveyed the concept, but they didn't say those words. And I'm so appreciative to the writers.
Yeah.
Because that is just the most corny thing now. Because it's been used and overused and quoted by politicians and all kinds of stuff. It's like,
right.
All right, it's when Obama is saying it, it's time to let it go and move on. So that being said, there's some key relationships in this movie that were kind of different than the previous movie. How did you feel about – let's start with the minor ones first. How did you feel about his relationship with his Uncle Ben?
As far as comparing it to the first?
Yeah, comparing them, contrasting them. Or let's just back up and say the character Uncle Ben. Did Martin Sheen do a good job? Did he do better than the previous guy?
Well, I have to say I am really not a big fan of the first three movies. So my apologies to anyone out there who just loves them, but I didn't. And so I found it very easy to distance this movie from the other movie.
Mm-hmm.
So just solely based on the performances in this movie and not comparing them to the older movies, I thought Martin Sheen did a good job. I really liked him as Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
I liked how they portrayed him, and they also did this with Aunt May, but they portrayed them more as real people and people that were, you know, in society, because Aunt May, the way we're used to seeing her, and Uncle Ben, is they were these old, feeble people that just kind of sat around in their house and did nothing. And
right.
But I really liked how in this movie, you could really relate to Uncle Ben and Aunt May as maybe even as relatives of your own. So they were really relatable people and real people, which I liked.
That's basically what I was going to say. Uncle Ben is not a crotchety old man in this movie. You know, you respect him. You like his character. He has a presence. Of course, Martin Sheen is an amazing actor. I've always been a fan of Martin Sheen's, even the work he did in Mass Effect 3. He was the best character in the entire series. So the man's got skills. And so when he's on screen in this movie, he's a believable character. He is a nice character, but he's also a pretty strong father figure. And just from his presence on camera, it implied that he could throw a punch, you know.
Right.
If push came to shove, he could take somebody out if he had to, you know. Not saying that he was ever physical in any way in the movie, but just he was a man. He wasn't an old man that needed protecting. He was a very dominant character, and I like that.
Yeah, I did too.
I like the way they presented his relationship with his wife, Aunt May, because, again, it was real. There's a joke in there about, by the way, guys, we are going to be spoiling this movie.
Yeah, that's just what I was about to say.
If you haven't seen this movie, go see it and then come back and listen to the podcast. But there's a joke in there about her meatloaf And you know, he accidentally says that, you know, no one likes your meatloaf, and she's going, I've been making it to you, for you for 35 years. And it was just, you know, it was a little joke, but it was real. The way they interacted was real. Their concern for Peter was real. Whenever they got upset with Peter, it wasn't, you know, and again, it wasn't, his grandparents weren't getting upset with him. These are people that were near his parents' age that could relate to him and could tell him
right.
what he needed to do. Yeah, so
you,
I thought that
and
that
you got to see them as young people, and you got to see him enter their family as a young boy, so you could actually understand the relationship that he had with them, because they were almost like his parents.
Right.
So I thought that was nice, too. Because I never, in the previous movies, I never felt, you know, what his character felt for his uncle and aunt, because I never understood how close they were supposed to be, because it just looked like, you know, he didn't really have anywhere to stay, so his grandparents took him in. Or a very distant relative that was in their 80s took him in that you couldn't relate to. So,
I thought that that was good. The scene, and there's a couple of key scenes that had to be in this movie, just because it followed the storyline. They did play very loosely with the narrative, but there were a couple of key scenes that had to be in this movie that were in the others. And as we're talking about, well, before we get into Uncle Ben's main scene, let's back up and talk about another character that they introduced fairly early on, Gwen Stacy. What did you think about Gwen Stacy and possibly comparing, you know, Emma Stone to Kirsten Dunst, who we had in that first trilogy?
Oh, simply, I loved Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy. I loved Gwen Stacy's character. I don't want to say throughout the whole movie. For some reason, it seemed like the movie had a little hard of a time starting off as far as the acting. In the beginning, to me, it seemed like the acting was a little spastic. And so I was a little concerned for all the characters. So it wasn't like I just fell in love with Gwen Stacy's character right off the bat. But as the movie progressed, I grew to like her more and more. And I by the end, I really, really liked her. So.
Yeah. No, I so much liked her character over Mary Jane in the first three movies because, in my mind, the first three movies had a lot of issues with how the characters interacted, but one of the main things was they never gave us a reason for why Peter liked Mary Jane. Like, you looked at Mary Jane as a character, and she's a pretty girl who fails a lot. That's basically, and he's a nerd, and the nerd liked the pretty girl, but the pretty girl was dating the football player, and the nerd gets superpowers, and then he gets the pretty girl. But you're not telling me why this character, Spider-Man, who is this amazing guy now, has these powers, has, you know, this dynamic personality, and is a true good person, likes this girl. I still don't know why Tobey Maguire liked Mary Jane.
Yeah, me neither.
No. But in this movie, they started off and they show you that, oh, she's not just a, and I say loser, this girl has brains.
Right.
This girl has personality. This girl has spunk. And she steps up to people. She even defends Peter at one point from Flash, the football player, basically, that picks on Peter in the beginning of the movie. They gave you reasons to like her as a character on her own. So she wasn't just a love interest for Peter Parker. She was a likable character on her own. She had something to offer the story on her own.
Right.
And you could then understand why, okay, this kid who's also into science, and by the way, Peter Parker is second in his class to her. Okay, they've got some common ground here. They could understand each other. This isn't a situation where the girl that can barely spell but has a pretty face is getting this guy who's a brain and a science nerd because all he cares about is the way she looks.
Right.
That's basically, in a nutshell, what the first movie boiled down to in the other trilogy.
Right.
But in this one, she was a very likable character, and as a result, you could see why they would end up liking each other.
Right.
You know? So I thought that her character was very organic, done very well, and I knew Emma Stone could act, but I was actually presently surprised with the way she acted in this movie. I thought she did a really good job.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like Emma Stone. You know, I liked her already, but I really liked her in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. So looking a little bit at the plot of the movie, it starts off with Peter's parents dropping off and rushing away, you know, in a hurry. His dad's a scientist who works for Oscorp. Okay, so this is the first place where this deviates. The first movie didn't show his parents at all. I am not exactly sure what the comic book origin of his parents were and what they did. I think they were a government agents or something. Don't quote me on that. But his dad did not work for Oscorp. His dad never worked for Oscorp. Additionally, Dr. Connors, the guy who becomes the lizard, was a university professor experimenting with recombinant DNA, technology similar to what created Spider-Man. He was not working for Oscorp in the comic books. So they did play loose with a little bit of the narrative also, but we still have that primary scene where, in this case, Peter Parker has snuck into Oscorp, basically, under the guise of an intern, and he sneaks into this room where there are these spiders. Come to find out his dad, as a scientist, created these spiders to weave this special silk, basically, that could be used by Oscorp in industrial applications because it's, you know, thin, light, stronger than steel. And as he's inside here watching this process, he actually gets into where the spiders are. The process finishes, and they all drop down. A bunch of them drop on him. One stays on him, bites him. So that scene, of course, stayed true to the original. He discovers his powers, and that was actually kind of funny because they went far a ways to show you that this was completely new to him and he couldn't control them.
Yeah.
And they showed him doing a lot of things by instinct, not even knowing that he could now, kind of highlighting that primal side of him that was not being awakened but had been added because of his DNA combining with the spider's DNA.
And in that respect, I really appreciated the time that they took to introduce the powers, because you didn't go from him, you know, realizing that he had a little bit of a special power to climbing on top of the buildings in the city in 5 minutes.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It took, I don't even know how long, but it was just as gradual as it was for the character. You know, it was gradual for the audience as well. So it was nice to have that happen slowly and not just, okay, now he's Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one thing that I thought was cool in the movie was so in this movie he doesn't develop the web as a biological thing. He actually has to build web shooters based on the technology he saw at Oscorp, which is kind of closer to what the comic book showed. But it took him time to learn how to shoot web and how to web sling. He wasn't necessarily good at it immediately. And I thought that was an interesting point because, yes, he's learned how to control his body and be acrobatic, but this web thing is still kind of new to him. And even after he had gotten the suit completely and he had, you know, kind of started into his role of hunting the lizard, he still did not understand certain things about how he could use his web, and it took him time as he was working to discover that. So I thought that was a cool, again, he's growing into his character,
right?
And we see him grow into his character rather than, you know, having a montage a series
right.
of cutscenes, and now he's the man. You're going, okay, that took 15 minutes. I thought that was cool. So in any case, the other scene that had to be in this movie that is integral to the story of Spider-Man, you know, we've got the spider bite, and the second most important thing is Uncle Ben. Uncle Ben's talking to him about responsibility, about power, and then Peter at first doesn't react well to it, and that's basically creates a chain of events in which Uncle Ben dies. I appreciated personally the way that they had this discussion because he screwed up, and it wasn't a big screw-up. He forgot to pick up his aunt from work because of some things that were caused by his powers, basically, and him getting wrapped up in things. And as a result, his uncle got mad at him because she had to walk, and, you know, and she walked through a dangerous subway in a neighborhood and ride the subway by herself. So he's talking to him about, you know, responsibility, and what he says to him, he says, you know, your dad lived by a creed that if you had the power to do good things, you had the responsibility to do those good things. It was a moral obligation to do what was right. If you had to do not just what was right, but what was good for in the best interest of others. I thought that was a cool concept because it's the same kind of idea with great power comes great responsibility. You know, you have to use it wisely. But instead of saying that, he's saying if you have the power to do something good for someone else, then you have the responsibility to do it. And then, of course, we had that chain of events where he sees the guy robbing the convenience store. He could chase after him and try to stop him. He doesn't. And eventually, I think what happens, Uncle Ben confronts the guy, right, and tries to stop him, and then he shoots him?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and again, I respected that because they gave his death the weight it needed. It wasn't like Parker ran up to him and held him and cried while Uncle Ben said his last few words to him, you know. And again, at the time, in the earlier Spider-Man movies, yeah, we were all drinking the Kool-Aid and everything was good, and so we enjoyed that. But with this one, it was a death scene. It was shocking, even though you kind of knew it was going to happen if you're familiar with the storyline. And Andrew Garfield did a much better job being emotional in that scene than Tobey Maguire did in the previous movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, Tobey Maguire was just kind of sitting there crying, you know, whereas you saw sadness in Andrew Garfield, you saw anger, you saw frustration, you saw guilt.
And shock.
And just this, and shock, yes, and shock. And just a span of, you know, how long did that scene last? Less than probably 2 or 3 minutes.
And I don't know about you, and I don't know if they'll do this, you know, if there is a sequel, but I was kind of relieved that we didn't have the whole long, drawn-out, emotional thing about, you know, Spider-Man or Peter Parker feeling guilt over his uncle's death as if it was, you know, all his fault. And they didn't show a big, you know, emotional scene between him and his aunt. And they didn't show a wedge being drawn between him and his aunt. That was kind of a relief to me that that wasn't in there because I really didn't like that in the other movies for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. Having a character that's driven by guilt only lasts so long because people want to feel anger with the hero. They even want to feel a little bit of sadness. Certainly they want to feel joy with the hero, but people don't enjoy feeling guilt along with the main character.
Right.
So, yeah, although that could be there, and certainly there was probably a little bit of it there, they didn't draw it out. Basically what happens is he becomes angry and he starts hunting down the guy that killed his uncle.
And I don't know if it was just the way Tobey Maguire acted out the guilt, or I don't know, but by the end it just ended up being more of like pathetic or pitiful. And so but with Andrew Garfield, it's like you didn't pity him, or he didn't look pathetic. He always maintained a sense of, you know, he was a strong character, and you didn't have to pity him or feel sorry for him. And I think that's something that the former Peter Parker did not really pull off well.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but I like my superheroes to be strong. I don't like to think that they're, you know, I don't like to pity them or think that they're pathetic, so...
Well, he reacted to me in a much more realistic way because what he did is he withdrew. He started staying out late. Now, we all know that he was dressing up and he was going out on the streets basically searching for the guy that shot his uncle. But from his aunt's standpoint, she sees him dealing with this grief and this pain by withdrawing from her. And that's what people would normally do. A teenage guy in that situation would become withdrawn and closed off. He would walk around angry, which is what Peter did when he was at school. That scene was cool because he's back at school and he's angry. And you could see it in his demeanor and the way he walks through the school. And it just made the event way more, and you saw him taking that death and internalizing it and building on it as a character rather than having that death bog him down and hold him back.
Right, and somehow he managed to do all this grieving and fight through all this anger without succumbing to the urge to put on black eyeliner.
Oh, and yeah, I don't know. I guess he hasn't found the other suit yet, but yeah. Yeah, I hope they never do that. but yeah, so it was a very well done sequence because that moment is key into the formation of who Spider-Man is and why he does what he does, and they handle it very well in this movie. So the next couple of events, the story flashes back from Peter. Well, Peter contacts Doc Connors, who is the guy who used to work with Peter's dad. Is having trouble with breakthroughs on this cross, what do they call it, cross-species genetic engineering or something like that,
yes.
Basically mixing characteristics through playing with DNA between two different species of animal. And so he ends up working with Doc Connor. They end up having a breakthrough because Peter takes some of the equations. So Peter takes some of the equations that his dad used to use and shares them with the doctor, and then as a result, they make a breakthrough, and the doctor starts injecting himself with this, trying to regrow his arm. And that was a key moment, too, because in the comic books, that was his deal. He had lost a limb, he understood what it was like to be handicapped, and he wanted to fix that.
Right.
So as they move forward with that, the combination there kind of goes too far. He ends up taking on too much of the animal characteristics, and he starts basically terrorizing the city. And that's where Peter comes in as someone who is also superpowered to try to stop him. The mentor relationship between him and the doctor somewhat mirrored the mentor relationship between him and Norman Osborn in the first movie. But what I appreciated about this is they let the villain become the villain on his own, sort of, and didn't have a situation where they didn't all sit down for Thanksgiving dinner and stare across the table at each other, you know. some of that was a little bit hokey.
Yeah.
But that was all based on Peter's friendship with Osborn's son. I forgot his first name now. But And that character is not even in this movie at all. His son is not in this movie. They didn't try to foil him against, you know, the two brothers, one's favored and one's not. The whole Cain and Abel concept playing out through three movies, they didn't even worry about that. This is Peter Parker's movie. They let him own it. And I like the way this mentor-student relationship kind of worked out in the end and the way they grew it. So another interesting twist in this movie is Gwen Stacy, who's Peter's love interest, her dad is the chief of police. And so we saw the police reacting to Peter's efforts by calling him a vigilante and calling him, you know, someone who was harassing citizens. How did you feel that played out with that kind of whole triangle between Peter and Gwen Stacy's dad, Captain Stacy, and then Gwen Stacy herself? Do you think they handled that well?
I thought they did. I really, going to the scene where she invited him over for dinner, and and he starts talking to the dad about this new vigilante that's in the city, and the dad has obviously some negative things to say because he is the chief of police. But obviously Peter is defensive. Because he is the vigilante, but at the time, he's the only one that knows that. You know, I was thinking to myself, how are they going to do this? You know, because at one point, Gwen Stacy says, you know, we need to go get some air. We need to go outside. And I thought, oh, here we go. We're finally going to have the girly girl moment where she, you know, bites his head off because he didn't respect her daddy. And, you know, because in my mind, that's something that Mary Jane or Kirsten Dunst probably would have done, you know. How could you come in my house and talk to my dad like that? And I'm a little daddy's girl, and I have daddy issues. But, you know, we didn't have any of that. She just walked outside, and she said, well, that was interesting. And he reveals to her who he is. And she didn't, you know, she wasn't shocked and run off crying because now she has two men. She wants to be, you know, she wants to please her dad, but now she can't. You know, it wasn't all of that mess. She was automatically on Peter's side. She had no issues with the fact that her dad might not like it. And you saw them bond. And so it was, I thought they handled it well.
Yeah. One thing that they did consistently throughout the movie, and they even do it there, and they do it at the end of the movie. When Peter is feeling uncomfortable, he has trouble expressing himself. And I thought that they played that very well at the right moments because it kind of calls back to the who Peter Parker is. Yes, now he's got these powers, but in some ways he's still kind of an outsider, a little bit of a nerd, kind of on the side of things, not the popular flamboyant guy. And he never turns into that. You know, he never becomes this confident. I mean, when he's got the suit on and he's being sarcastic and he's playing his part, yeah. But him as Peter Parker, he never flips sides and turns into something else. So at that moment when he's trying to tell her and he's having a hard time talking or expressing himself, and he's like, "Man, maybe I shouldn't just do this because it's hard for me to say it, and I can't say it." I thought it was very fitting that at that point, because of her personality, she kind of got frustrated with him, started to walk away. And so then he shot her with the web and spun her around. I was like, that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it was.
Way to reveal that. And it wasn't the, you know, she walks up to him and they kiss and he dips her and,
right.
You know,
and
her leg
go,
goes up. Right
then they go flying off as they're connected to the Transco Tower or something.
Right. You know, it wasn't anything like that. So I thought
it was more realistic, which I always tend to appreciate. Obviously, you know, it is a lot of fiction because you have a man that turns into a lizard and you have also have a man that can climb buildings, but they stayed as grounded as they could. And so it was a lot easier to relate to the movie and feel like you were a part of it.
Right. I mean, this movie is going to be a little bit unrealistic. It's going to be a little bit science fiction. You're not going to get the Dark Knight. We're never going to get the Dark Knight out of a Spider-Man movie because you can't ground it in that way because his powers are something that's never happened to anyone, you know?
Right.
So as a result, you have to kind of stretch your mind to believe, but when it came to the actual character interactions and how they would react to things, that was very, very grounded and real.
Yes.
And that's certainly definitely appreciated. So one thing I thought that was cool was when Peter... The first time Peter tracks the lizard to the sewers, because that's where the lizard's staying. You have this scene where Doc Connors is upping his dosage and shooting himself again to transform and grow his arm back. Peter shoots web in all directions. I thought this was so cool because, you know, spiders can do this. He shoots webs in all directions in this kind of central network where all these pipes in the sewer come together. And he lays on the web, and he's just kind of playing around, but he can feel vibrations in the sewers and what's going on. And what piques his interest was he starts to feel his web vibrating. And I thought that was an interesting and kind of a cool callback to the way spiders are and how they operate. Whenever something's caught, they know it because their web vibrates as they try to fight it, and they can...
Oh, yeah. I didn't pick up on that, but that is really neat. Yeah. I like that, too.
It was a really cool scene. He ends up confronting the lizard, and... obviously, the lizard is much stronger than he is, much more powerful. So that battle happens, you know, as always in these superhero movies, that battle happens once, but it happens over and over again until the final resolution. One thing that was interesting that pushed Doc Connors to actually inject himself with the serum to change himself into a lizard was the fact that he was being shut down. And because he wasn't generating results in his program for Oscorp the way he needed to, and the guy who I would view as the true villain, one of the Oscorp, I guess the guy over him that works at Oscorp, basically said, I'm going to take this and I'm going to start human trials. I'm going to drop it off at a clinic and tell them that it, and have them administer it as flu vaccine, and we'll just see what happens to the people. And so Doc Connors realizes that he needs to accelerate his development to try to stop him from doing this, and eventually, changes into the lizard to chase the guy down, to try to stop him from doing it. And I thought that was an interesting way to show that this man who compromises on his morals is not necessarily a horrible person. He's not a mass murderer. He's not a psycho. He's pushed into a situation, and he does what he thinks he has to do.
Right.
And as a result, the process of doing that slowly drives him insane. Every time he changes into the lizard, he becomes less and less grounded and more crazy.
Right.
And I thought that was a cool way to develop the villain.
Yeah.
There is a plot where he kind of loses his mind, and he's going to connect this dispersion system to the top of Oscorp Tower that will basically shoot out a cloud of the serum that he used to transform himself and transform the entire city into lizard people. And again, me saying it like that sounds really far-fetched and very hokey sci-fi, but the way they present it in the movie is a little bit better.
Well, and I liked how there's one, at one point, I think it was toward the end, but he's actually explaining why he is doing what he's doing, and you can understand why he thinks that way, because he is missing an arm, so he... through most of his life, has felt weak and feeble, and he's wanted to feel strong and capable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the reason why it goes to his head when he turns into a lizard, because the character that they presented, you would think when he turns into a lizard, it would scare him and he wouldn't do it anymore. But when he turns into a lizard, he realizes, you know, I've been searching for the wrong thing. I've been wanting to make myself as a human strong, but I realize now that humans are weak. Even at their strongest point, humans are weak. But when I became this creature or this reptile, I realize now I'm strong. So I've been searching for the wrong solution the whole time. Instead of making humans stronger, I should just turn them into something that is non-human, since humans are weak. And so then you understand that his whole reasoning is to actually help society by turning all of these humans into non-human creatures that are actually stronger than themselves. So in a weird, twisted way, he's actually trying to benefit society.
And that was an interesting point, because he goes in, he's talking about how I want to make people, you know, stronger, and I want to fix these genetic deformities and handicaps people have. You know, whenever he starts injecting himself with this, his eyesight gets better. He gets faster. He gets stronger. He grows his arm back. And then he says, you know what? It's not about making the human form strong. It's about trying to achieve perfection. And perfection is now when I can leverage basically these qualities that I have when I'm a lizard with my humanity and become something completely inhuman but new and superior.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting. And it's not like I'm trying to now hold this for myself and be the supreme being. I want to give this to everyone.
Right.
Now, it's insane, but that's what his overarching idea was, that he wanted to help mankind.
Right. And you could always kind of maintain some kind of sympathy toward him, because even his fight against Spider-Man or Peter Parker was not a personal vendetta. It was just that Peter Parker or Spider-Man was getting in his way, and he even told them, you know, I'm doing something good here. There's no need to stop me. And so his goal was never to, you know, kill Spider-Man or kill Peter Parker. In fact, he'd probably prefer not to do that, but because Spider-Man was trying to stop him from benefiting, you know, humankind, or, you know, benefiting the greater good, then he was like, well, I have to, you know, get who's ever in my way out of my way so I can follow through with this. So
exactly. He's another obstacle in the way of his, you know, quest to better himself and mankind, and so he had to be dealt with.
But if Peter Parker had ever said, okay, I'm out, you know, do whatever you want, then he would have just left him alone. So it wasn't like he was this evil guy that was just out to just kill everybody or anything.
With that in mind, it reminds me of shortly after the first real time that Spider-Man and the Lizard fight. He goes back, tries to get Gwen Stacy's help because he's all cut up from the Lizard. And it was interesting how they leveraged her character having a father who's a police officer and how she felt about what Peter was doing.
Yeah.
Basically, she says, well, you know, I know what this is, because I fear my dad not coming home every night. And every time you've put on that suit, that's what I'm going to be scared of. But at the same time, Peter says, you know, I have to stop this lizard. I'm the only one who can. And she says, this is not your job. Well, you know, maybe it is. And I thought that was interesting, because not only you could she knew what this was going to be. She knew what she was getting into. She had her concerns. But because of the sacrifice that her dad makes every day as a police officer, she also understood why Peter had to do what he had to do.
Right.
And so now, once again, you have a companion for Peter Parker who is empowering him as Spider-Man rather than holding him back.
Yes, and I think that's what I really liked about the way they portrayed her character. Mary Jane was always, not only was she usually having girl issues, you know, I'm not getting enough attention, or, you know, Peter doesn't love me, or, you know, whatever. But aside from that, even though that is annoying, she was always a nuisance to him or a thorn in his side. She was never, it didn't seem like she was, you know, because we're on Peter Parker's side, obviously. He's a character we're there for. And so we want to see him go through his journey, and then when you have Mary Jane always being a nuisance or bringing him down, it's just kind of an irritation throughout the movie. But with Gwen Stacy, she was always there to support him, and even when she had concerns or drawbacks, she encouraged him to follow through with that, with whatever he felt like he needed to follow through with. She was never something pulling him back or bringing him down. And so in that way, as a member of the audience, you could kind of embrace her along with him because you appreciated her as a character. So.
Right. And see, and that's something that's also from the comic books that I guess they didn't get into in the first trilogy, but the relationships that he has with Aunt May and Mary Jane in the comic books are kind of like Batman's relationship with Alfred in a way, in that they ground him and they empower him to do what he needs to do.
Yeah.
Whenever he's not going to be somewhere, they don't make him feel guilty. They say, I understand, you have a greater good. Go out there and help people. And so in some ways, they inspire him to be the hero that he needs to be.
Yeah.
Whereas in the first movie, again, you saw, just like you said, Mary Jane was an obstacle for him, in the way of him being the hero that he needed.
Yes, exactly.
She was holding him back. She was a bad decision that he kept getting sidetracked by, and someone that he would need to give his powers up for to have, rather than someone who could assist him along his way and kind of be pulled into that whole cohesive storyline of what makes Peter Parker Spider-Man.
Yes, because I remember thinking in the older movies, when she finally knew who he was, and they finally, did they ever get married? Or there was one scene where she was in a wedding dress, but I think she had left her wedding, and so she was running to Peter because she wanted to be with him. I don't know if they ever got married or they just were together, but it's like when that happened, I wasn't excited because it was two people that loved each other that were getting together. I was just happy that it was finally out of the way and we can move on. Because I'm like, oh, great, this is over with. She knows what he's doing and she's accepted it, and now she'll finally stop whining and we can get on with the story.
Yeah.
But with Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy in the new movie, I wanted them to be together because they really liked each other. And, you know, you just wanted them to be together for that reason, nothing else.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you could embrace her and respect her as a character. And she felt like she was on Spider-Man's side, which puts her on your side.
Right.
And so you can all move forward. Yeah, that was an interesting, a very good way that they handled their relationship. Now, as the movie progresses, the Lizard's trying to release this toxin throughout the city that'll change everyone's form. And Peter is going to stop him. In the process of this, he gets apprehended by Gwen Stacy's dad, and he finds out that, you know, Gwen Stacy's dad unmasks him, but eventually lets him go because he realizes he needs to, the city needs his help at this point. The situation's dire. As he's leaving, one of the men fires off a shot at him and hits him in the leg. So now grazes his leg. It's not like he takes a true bullet to the leg, but it hurts him. So now he can't get to the tower to stop him in time on his own. And I thought that this was interesting because throughout the Spider-Man movies, they've always tried to show how the city of New York helps Spider-Man and how Spider-Man is New York's hero, you know, and how the people of New York are backing him and, you know, they love him and whatever. But it always seemed a little canned, a little hokey.
Well, you know, it was always with the little lady on the corner singing the Spider-Man song. That
was
how they
showed it. You know, or random people on a bridge throwing cans at the villain going, if you mess with him, you mess with all of us because we're New York. Really? You know, yeah, because them throwing tin cans at a man who's flying and is super strong is going to make a statement. But in this one, what happens is basically because he saves this guy's kid, this guy organizes some construction workers to help him out and basically give him a bridge And I guess you could see the movie to see what kind of bridge it is. But basically, give him a bridge so he can cross the city faster to get to the tower. And I thought that was a good way of showing how the city kind of came together. You know, they stopped traffic. Everything kind of, they all solidified at this one moment because Spider-Man, we need you. He's up there. Go get him.
I love that because he was kind of at the time, because he was hurt and he had such a far way to travel to get to Oscorp, it was almost like he was kind of losing his will and his, not determination, because he was determined to get there, but, you know, he was discouraged. Yeah. And then when he saw that everyone was chipping in to help him, it was like, it showed him that, you know, we're on your side. We want you to do this. And it like gave him his second win to keep going.
Yeah. And so that was a really cool moment. It was a really important moment in the movie, because not only is he finally congealed into who he is, but now the city has recognized him. They're around him and they're supporting him. And now we have the final component in place of what makes Spider-Man, you know, the hero that he is, you know.
And I loved how what motivated that, because it all started with the guy that he helped, you know, when the lizard first came onto the scene, so to speak. A little boy was in danger in a car, and his dad, you know, he was scared of losing him, but Spider-Man saved the little boy and gave it to the dad. And, you know, you see that all the time in superhero movies where they're helping civilians. But it's always kind of a one-sided thing, and the civilian always, in a sense, comes off looking selfish, like, oh, good, I'm so glad you were here to serve me. But it was really neat how they turned that around, and the civilian, it really touched his heart that Spider-Man really put his own life in danger to save his son. And you saw that he kept that feeling with him, you know, throughout the duration of the time that Spider-Man saved his son to the time that the lizard was attacking Oscorp, because then that feeling is what motivated him to assist Spider-Man. So it was really nice to see it as a two-sided thing or a two-way street where the civilians actually return the favor.
Yeah, in a real tangible way. They saw his sacrifice and that what he was doing was truly selfless.
Right.
And then they supported him. They appreciated it. They supported him, and they helped him.
And they're not just dumb blockheads. You know, they actually have a heart, and they, you know, appreciate what he did. And then they saw a chance where they could actually help too, and so they followed through with that.
Yeah. It was a really cool moment. Spider-Man ends up making it to the tower. We've got Gwen Stacy's dad, who goes up into the tower to assist. Now, interestingly, Spider-Man has Gwen Stacy go to Oscorp before he knows the lizard's headed there and make an antidote to the lizard's biotoxin, basically. And I thought that there was a really interesting Jurassic Park moment.
Yeah.
Where she's hiding in this room, and she's hiding with the device that the lizard needs to spread this toxin across the entire city. And she's in there, and she's, you know, she's breathing hard, and you hear the guy outside this grate, just like, you know, a velociraptor. As soon as I heard that, I thought, he sounds exactly like a velociraptor off of the first Jurassic Park movie. But he rips it open, and he sees her, and she has this aerosol can and a match, so she tries, you know, create a makeshift flamethrower out of it to keep him away.
Again, someone who has brains, they're not just gonna...
Yeah. She just wasn't going to stand there and get killed and get her head cut off.
Right, and wait for Spider-Man to hopefully come save her.
You know, but he rips it open and he sees her, but this was Gwen Stacy was the head intern in his program. So, again, he's not just a mindless killing machine.
Right.
He actually has an objective. He takes the device and walks off, like, whatever, you know.
Right, because he knew, you know, she's really not going to get in my way, so I have no reason to harm her.
Yeah, yeah. So she's not a threat. So the lizard sets everything up, and then Gwen Stacy's dad goes up there to help Spider-Man.
Can we go back to that one scene that you were talking about where she's in the closet? And I remember being on pins and needles in that scene, and usually I don't get that wrapped up into these movies, but I did. And I think part of the reason was the music that they used in that scene, which I really liked. It was kind of like a throwback to Oh, what's that movie that you recommended to me with Audrey Hepburn and she's blind and...
Oh, Wait Until Dark.
Yeah, Wait Until Dark.
That is an amazing movie.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
Movies from that time period where the scene's supposed to be really gripping and you're supposed to be on pins and needles, and they use the sound from a piano, and it's like banging on piano keys. And every time you hear that sound where they're banging on piano keys, it's like you get more and more tense. And they did that in this scene, and I really liked it.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very well-shaped scene. That was actually one of the, I wouldn't say the best scene in the movie, but it was a very well orchestrated scene. You knew there was a specific feeling they were trying to create, and they actually, you know, they reached out, they grabbed the audience, and they pulled them into that scene with her. It was very cool.
Yeah.
But in any case, in the process of trying to stop the lizard and help Spider-Man, Gwen Stacy's dad gets killed by the lizard. He gets stabbed through the abdomen, basically. So he's lying there, he's dying. Eventually, of course, Spider-Man goes up, saves the day, swaps out the toxin with the antidote, and so it shoots the antidote all over the city. Because there are a few people that had already been infected by the lizard. They end up, you know, being cured of that disease. And then there's a moment where Peter comes back down and gets a chance to talk with Gwen Stacy's dad before he dies. And I thought that this was a very cool moment in the movie, because now we have the resolution to her dad's character in the story arc, from hating Spider-Man, seeing him as a vigilante, to seeing him help the city, to changing and now supporting him. And that's one thing that always bothered me about Jameson, the editor of the Daily Bugle. Time and time again, Spider-Man would save the city, and the editor of the Daily Bugle would give him crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city was about to be melted down. Spider-Man obviously steps up, saves everyone's lives, and then Jameson wants to cuss him out or unmask him or whatever. You know, that character to me, especially in the movies, just stopped making sense after a while. It was like, really? You're still not a believer?
Right.
But seeing this character arc for Captain Stacy was a very rewarding thing, because he was a thinking person. He was a reasonable person. He saw how Spider-Man was benefiting the city, and he basically gives him his blessing, but says, I know that what you're going to put on the line and what you're going to have to risk. You know, he's a cop, so he's looking at Spider-Man. He's saying, I know what you're up against. I know what you're going to have to deal with. Promise me that you won't get my daughter mixed up in this. And you could tell Spider-Man didn't want to do it, but he promises that he won't get the girl mixed up into that. That moment was a stroke of genius in the movie, because one of the strangest letdowns. They explained it, but in the first movie, how do you keep this back and forth, boy meets girl, still chasing after girl on in successive sequels of the movie? Well, at the end of Spider-Man 1, basically, he's got Mary Jane as his girlfriend and says, I can never love you, I just want to be your friend. And he walks away in his head talking about responsibility, you know, talking to himself again. And in this movie, it's her father's dying wish that as he saves the city, don't put my daughter at risk. What person cannot honor that? Okay?
Right. It's like they pulled it off without making anyone annoying.
Yes. I'm like, that all makes sense. All the characters' motivations were there, laid plain out. It was great. And then the way he handles it, of course, things progress. He is at the funeral, but he's kind of like hiding up in the shadows. And she's thinking, you know, where is Parker at my dad's funeral? She goes and visits. And he basically says, I can't do this anymore. And he doesn't give any more explanation because, again, he's uncomfortable. He's having trouble expressing himself. And as she's walking away, you think that she's just – in my mind, I thought she was just going to hate him forever.
Well, that's what we're waiting for. We're always waiting for him to just make the slightest wrong move and everyone to turn on him as if they have no thinking ability whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. And Mary Jane did it many, many times
in
the previous trilogy.
Yes.
So as she's walking away, I'm like, she's going to say, I hate you forever, Parker, or something. But she turned and she looked at him and she said, my dad made you promise, didn't he?
Yes, I love that part, because I was like, finally, we have a girl that will stop and just think for a moment and realize, you know, what's really going on here and put two and two together. And yeah, she's not happy about it, but she's not rolling her eyes and just, you know, acting like Peter's just an idiot or something.
Yeah. Yeah. She's giving him some credit and the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
You know, and as a result, she kind of understands, although she's not happy about it, like you said, she understands why he's doing what he's doing and that he's really respecting her and respecting her father's dying wishes by doing that. And so she steps back and says, you know, kind of, I understand.
I don't know about you, but right when Gwen Stacy's father died, it was very sad. And then I was thinking, oh, great. Now Gwen Stacy's going to, for some reason, be mad at Peter because she's going to think, well, none of this would have happened if it wasn't for you and your lizard friend. And
see, that's what I thought. I thought she was going to blame him for her father's death. I was like, really? And then they completely surprised me and say, no, she's not an idiot.
And all she wanted was for him to be at the funeral. And then that's what she was upset about, the fact that he wasn't at the funeral. And you thought, well, that's a reasonable thing to be upset about.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And then when he explained it, she wasn't happy, but she understood.
Right.
And then, of course, the way it plays out is, oh, it's funny, one of the jokes, when he comes home after defeating the lizard, and he hands his aunt the eggs that he was supposed to get like 3 days ago when she asked him to. It was a very funny moment. But then they hugged. And I was like, whoever designed these scenes really understood the character of Spider-Man. Maybe they played around with his origin a little bit, but there are certain things that are key. When they hug, she just saw on the news that the lizard had been defeated. He walks in. He's been... They beat the crap out of him. He's got cuts all over his face. The implication I got was she knows, okay? This is an unspoken knowledge. She knows he's Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's what I got, too.
She's not going to make him admit it. He's not going to talk about it, but she knows he's Spider-Man. She hugs him, and I'm like, and that is that was the final piece in making Spider-Man who he was.
And not only does she know, but I thought, I could be wrong, but I thought that they were also implying that he knew that she knew.
Possibly so.
Yeah.
Because there was that, he's got that support structure. The city, and then his relationship with his aunt, and his Gwen Stacy, or in the future, possibly Mary Jane. But
and then he said, he said to his aunt, you know, yeah, it's been kind of a rough day, like, he knew, obviously, that she knew it had been a rough day.
Yeah.
So that's what kind of made me think that he knew that she knew, but it was just going to continue to be kind of an unspoken thing between them.
Right. He's not going to bring it up, she's not going to bring it up, but she knows where he's going every night.
Right. And then they didn't have this looming guilt over him that, you know, finally, you know, they have a really good relationship, but we know in movie number two, he's going to have to reveal to her that it was his fault that her husband's dead. You know, because in real life, that probably wouldn't be something you could come back from, but but somehow they did in the other movies. They just, you know, bounced back from it. But
and that's the other thing. He never viewed it as he doesn't view it as his killing his uncle.
No.
But what he realized was, if I had done the good thing that I could have done, I could have prevented that from happening.
Right.
And so there's a regret over not stopping it, but he doesn't feel like he pulled the trigger and shot his uncle.
Right.
Which is what they implied in all the other movies, was that Parker basically felt guilt, like he threw his uncle off a building.
Yes, and in the other movie, at that point where he finally confessed this guilt that he had, you know, that we had all been carrying throughout the entire time we'd been watching these movies, and he finally told Aunt May, because we had been feeling the guilt with him, I don't know about you, but I wanted Aunt May to be kind of like a mentor or an older aunt, like she should have been, and said, you know, I'm glad that you told me, and kind of like a support system or a comfort to him. But instead, she just was just totally taken back by it, and she just couldn't handle it, and how
she pulls away
from how dare you, and it's like, man, I feel so rejected right now.
Yeah, because in some way, you are putting yourself in the position of this man. And so when his aunt rejects him, that was like the worst part of the movies of all three. It was like, really? So this was all just hanging over.
Yeah, exactly. And then she just brushes it off later, like, oh, it's okay, darling.
You know, I thought about it, and it's okay. And you're going, what?
It's like, no, it's not okay. You're a dumb, you know.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot when I needed you.
Exactly. When I needed you, you kicked me, and now that I don't need you, you're fine.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. Yeah.
And now you still want me to move this dumb box for your garage sale or whatever.
Yeah. Whatever the heck
I didn't like that.
Yeah. No, the relationship between him and Aunt May, I they didn't spend a whole lot of time talking to each other in the movie, but I felt that at that moment, that hug and their simple dialogue said so much more than having them sit down at a table and have a discussion about how they felt about Uncle Ben's death, you know?
Right.
You said so much more in the body language and in the way the scene was shot and the implications of the dialogue than tons of exposition ever could have.
Yeah.
And I think that's really just the power of the actors that were in this movie, as well as the director understanding how to communicate non-verbally in a movie.
Yes. That hug, I know, I really I liked that hug too. Yeah. It was so motherly and so comforting. You felt comforted along with it.
Right. It was very well played. And then, of course, you have at the very end of the movie, the last scene where he's sitting in the class. He was late. He comes in, sits behind Gwen Stacy. The teacher says, "You're late again." He says, "I'm so sorry. I promise that I'll never let it happen again." And the teacher says, "Don't make promises that you can't keep." And he whispers to Gwen Stacy, "But those are the best kind." And, you know, she smiles because it implies that, yes, he's trying to stay away from her, but we all know he's not going to be able to do that. And so the love interest and the back and forth that they've had throughout this movie is not just going to fall flat, but it's going to continue. It's going to go on.
Yes, I like that too.
And so they set up for them to build their relationship further in the next movie, which to me is an awesome – it's an awesome idea to take these two characters and build them toward each other rather than throw them together 100%, rip them apart, and then have them back and forth with each other all the way to the end of the movie. I mean, just the way the relationship between Mary Jane and Peter Parker in the first three movies was just irritating.
Yeah, I found it to be irritating too.
Because, I mean, he was an undependable loser.
Yeah.
And
a puny pipsqueak.
Yeah. It's like, Peter Parker may be a nerd, but he doesn't have to be. And then Mary Jane was so ready to condemn him for anything. I'm going, why do you like this girl?
Yeah, why does she like him? It's like every move he makes, she gets annoyed. And it's like, well, can you just go find someone else then if you just dislike his guts so much?
You guys need to agree never to talk to each other again. That's going to make you both.
Yeah, stop putting us all through this, because we're just trying to understand what happens to the villain, and y'all are getting in the way.
And that was the other thing that was a problem with the other movies. Parker, the star of the other movies had to be the villains, because Parker was so left and right and up and down and got depressed and lost his powers and couldn't deliver a pizza on time even though he's Spider-Man and, you know, all this. He couldn't get his life together. He was kind of a loser. Even a Spider-Man.
Yeah. But in Andrew Garfield and this Peter Parker, he never came across to me as someone who was wimpy, ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it actually made you feel safe, because it's like, okay, this guy is not a wimp. He may be small physically.
Yeah.
You know, just he had kind of had a petite structure. And yeah, maybe socially he's a little awkward or not confident completely socially. And, maybe he has a little bit of some nerd tendencies, but that doesn't mean he is a wimp. He can still take care of things. And I really liked how they did that, because who wants their superhero to be a wimp? No one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not watching this to see a superhero that can swing through buildings and bend steel, but can't make it across the street without tripping and falling down a manhole.
Right.
You know, he's not a klutz.
I mean, Superman did that, but it's because he was doing it on purpose.
Right, right. He wasn't just an idiot. He had a reason he was doing that. Yeah, yeah. So, very good movie. I thought it was awesome.
Again, don't be too, like, when it first starts, I was a little worried because, I don't really know how to explain it. The acting was a little bit spastic. I don't know if that's the right word, but it was like, I don't know, something about it didn't flow smoothly, and so I was a little worried. Mm. But I'm not sure when it happened, but all of a sudden, it's like it started flowing better.
Yeah, it's like it's got its rhythm. I thought that the beginning was just slightly slow. Because they included his parents in it, which was kind of new for me, I thought that was kind of felt off. And it was really about building characters rather than showing him, giving you a lot of hyped action scenes with Spider-Man. There was tons of that in there.
Yeah.
But the star of the show really was Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker as people.
Yeah, and there were some times in the beginning where Andrew Garfield was acting, and I don't know if it was just me not being able to interpret things, but I was having a hard time understanding what he was trying to convey in his acting. It was like he was a little, I keep saying spastic, but it was like he would just say things and he would move quickly, and I'm like, what is he trying to show us? I was a little confused in the beginning. But then after a while, it kind of smoothed out.
Yeah,
so.
It evened out. Yeah,
so don't, you know, if you feel that way, maybe not everyone will feel that way. Some people may think it's just fine. But if you do kind of feel that way in the beginning, don't give up on the movie because it gets really good.
Yeah, yeah. So just overall, I thought it was an excellent movie. It was worth my $15 to go see it. Any final thoughts, Gamer Girl? As far as you're concerned about The Amazing Spider-Man?
Well, I think it was amazing, so I think that they chose the title well. It was The Amazing Spider-Man.
Great, great. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Mindspace Podcast. I'd like to thank Gamer Girl, and I'm going to be trying to do this a little bit more regularly. I'll be hitting video games, movies, and anything else. Thank you so much for downloading the show, and again, you can find me at www.mindspacepodcast.wordpress.com. Thanks so much for downloading the show, and I hope you have a great day.